What is a religion? Why is Buddhism a religion? And because, like many such questions, on the one hand you can say, well, who cares, it's just a matter of definition and so what? But if you allow it to, rather than dismissing questions, and if you allow them to you allow them to stay, if you give questions some space and some time, then they often will call things up. The nature of a question is to call up a response. And the longer that you allow it and the bigger the space that you give it, the deeper and the more meaningful are the kinds of things that the question will call up. So even though the question arose in a somewhat limited and worldly context, the idea of, well, how do you legally define religion? But for me, it's opened up a sort of a perception on what we're doing, which is gives more of a holistic perspective on what we actually do that's religious. There's a famous saying in Chinese circles, they say, before enlightenment, chop wood and carry water. After enlightenment, chop wood and carry water. It's a typical Zen-ish kind of thing. It might actually be a Taoist saying. And like so many of these sayings, it captures in a simple image a very deep truth, and that is the truth that life goes on. Or as Jack Kornfield put it in one of his book titles a few years ago, after the ecstasy, the laundry. So when you're in meditation, you have all these experiences and so on. You might not be in meditation, could be any time. But life goes on. Next morning, you know, you come down and there's a bowl of noodles or Weet-Bix or whatever, and everything is pretty much the same. You have to go to the toilet and you have to, you know, drink a glass of water and go and do the chores or all of those things. So in one sense, what we do in terms of spiritual life doesn't. There are these different aspects of it, and they're quite independent of each other in a very pragmatic sense. You know, the cleaning needs to be done, the cooking needs to be done, the looking after the place, and all of these things need to be done. And whether you're enlightened or not, and whether you've been sitting in jhanas all night or not, or whether you've been going through a crisis of spiritual angst or not, doesn't really matter. Those things have to get done. And that's not a bad thing. That's one of the ways that we kind of keep grounded in our spiritual practice. Keep a kind of contact with each other and keep a contact with reality. So for me, one of the ideas or one of the notions behind real religion is that it's very encompassing, is that somehow it informs everything, somehow it changes everything. Even those things that are completely mundane, even those things that seem completely unreligious, are somehow transformed because they're put in that context with the things that are religious. in circles of anthropology and so on, one of the words which people use to, various words that people use to try to describe or highlight religious experience, and one of the words that people use is the numinous, that religious experience has this numinous quality. And what numinous means, of course, is difficult to define. As with all of these things, we think that we define it. In fact, we just shift the uncertainty from one word onto another word. But somehow, the idea of the numinous means something like something where there's a feeling of a contact with a greater reality, somehow a feeling of being lifted outside oneself, standing outside. It's a literal meaning of the word ecstasy, is standing beside or standing outside. And so there's a kind of the world becomes heightened, and the consciousness becomes expanded, that there's seen an essence of things which is alive or is filled with a sense of meaning which you hadn't perceived before. There are, of course, many different ways that the numinous can be experienced, and the way that we interpret it and the way that we articulate it are very much determined by the particular religious background that we come from. From a Buddhist point of view, of course, we will tend to interpret things as being meditation experiences and samadhi experiences. We'll see them from primarily a psychological point of view, and the questions that we'll be asking will be questions about things like, well, how do I develop this? What do I do now? What does this mean? And so on, in terms of spiritual or meditative development. And so this is a very much an Eastern kind of idea, is the idea of development or cultivation in our practice. From a Western religious point of view, these things tend to be seen more as an act of grace. There's something which descends on someone, often for purely arbitrary reasons, the whim of God. Somehow he comes down and talks to Noah or to Jonah, or he manifests as the burning bush to Paul. Why those individuals? Well, often there doesn't seem to be a particularly any particular reason for it. And it's just something that happens. It's not something that you sort of understand and do anything with. It's just something that happens to you. So I think this is quite a major difference between the experience of the numinous in Eastern religions and Western religions. In Eastern religions, they're not something that just happens, even though they do seem sometimes arbitrary, sometimes it is. It does just happen. You're just in meditation. This meditation doesn't seem that different from 1,000 other meditations, but somehow in this meditation, mind becomes filled with light and with bliss. And so you can understand how it seems like it's a sort of an external gift, like a sense of grace which has been bestowed upon you from an inscrutable power. But in Buddhism, we acknowledge that even though it seems like that, in reality, it's just a psychological phenomena which arises through the development of meditation, the ripening of karma and so on. And so we have these experiences, and they can be very profound and they can be very transformative. It's very common to have numinous experiences in meditation. It's, of course, even more common to not have them. And of course, many people meditate for long periods of time without ever having anything like that. Other people, what's one thing that's quite common is that when you start out meditating and you're practicing, and somehow you fall into this thing, and this kind of state appears, a light appears in the mind, or you feel like you're taken outside of your body, or can manifest in various different kinds of ways, and somehow it happens. And there's a transformation that happens, even if you just experience that once. You know, and you can see in many of these cases in the Western stories, a case like, say, Paul and the burning bush is a case of point where, you know, it seems that he basically only had one directly numinous experience, but that transformed his whole life and the direction of his life. So even one of these experiences can be very transformative. It shows you that reality is far greater than we had formerly known. It shows us that there is a truth, that there is some kind of transformation. And so what we have in Buddhism is a teaching on meditation, a teaching on psychology and so on, which allows us to understand these things, at least to some degree, and it allows us to show us that that these things are actually normal, that there's nothing, you know, mad about it, there's nothing strange about it. It's just when the defilements and obscurations in the mind are lessened through paying attention in the right way, through developing your mind in the right direction, then these experiences tend to arise, experiences of light or of bliss or of oneness and so on and so forth. And of course the meditation instructions can go into quite some detail about how this actually happens. The important thing, so this can happen just randomly. It can happen to somebody who's just starting out in meditation. Sometimes it can happen to somebody when they don't know anything about Buddhism or meditation, and it just happens, and then they look around and try to find an explanation for it, and then they find Buddhism has an explanation. Or it can happen to somebody who's a newcomer to Buddhist meditation, and then you start practicing, and maybe you hear a few people talking about nimittas and jhanas and so on, and then you meditate and these things happen, and you think, wow, that's it. And you know, you imagine that everybody else is doing the same thing. Or maybe you meditate and it doesn't happen, and you think, oh, I'm the only one who doesn't have jhanas, and everybody else is sitting there blissing away and so on. Of course, the reality is that meditation experience is incredibly varied. And if you haven't read it, I recommend reading William James's classic, The Varieties of Religious Experience. And the first book, first major work, which looked at how people actually experience religiously, how they experience numinously. And it was one of the first books that really emphasized this notion of religious experience. It's about 100 years old or something now. Previously in the West, of course, religion was usually defined in terms of doctrine or in terms of an organizational structure or something like that, adherence to a creed. And William James was one of the first to point out to the fact that what actually was very central in many people's religious identity was their experience of something out of the ordinary, something numinous. And these experiences are incredibly varied. And he does a nice job of just documenting with different people's accounts. So when these experiences happen or don't happen, then the meditation, what goes on in meditation is one thing, and then the other thing is what is what do we do then afterwards when we open our eyes and come out of meditation, when we have to come and live. Life doesn't stop. And unlike in the typical Western situation where these things, because they're a grace, a gift of God, something which descends arbitrarily on you, then you can't really do anything about it. So in the Eastern perspective, there's very much is something that we can do about it. That there are things, these are things which are bhavetabha, to be developed, to be made more of, to be made greater, as well as to be understood. So one question which we can ask, one of the great problems which we have in Buddhism and Buddhist practice is this integration of these two different aspects, the aspect of the numinous experiences which we put so much effort into and place so much value on. You know, going away into our kuti and meditating, and it's like the Holy Grail, except it's not something which is sort of out there, but it's something that's in there. It's like the best thing you can do in Buddhism, and especially in the forest tradition. And so we invest a lot in it, emotionally, spiritually. We we praise people who spend a lot of time in seclusion and a lot of time in meditation. We feel disappointed if we don't do that. We feel can feel depressed if we are trying to meditate and it's not going well, or we feel guilty if we haven't put the effort into meditation that we should have done. So all of these things are signs of the depth of the value that we put in the notion of meditation and the notion of achieving these kinds of numinous states. And some people have responded to this and gone so far as to say, well, look, we shouldn't, you know, meditation shouldn't be about these things at all. So you have people like Joko Beck who talked about just the ordinary mind, nothing special, and so that meditation is not nothing to do with notions of attaining any particular state of enlightenment or anything like that. I think that's a little bit an extreme. But it is important to remember that a state in meditation is just that. It's just a state in meditation. It's not the whole of your life. And so our question becomes, well, how does that state then relate to the rest of what we're doing? And this is where I think the notion of our practice here as a religion or as a whole practice is relevant. You know, we're not doing something which you can just sort of go into a lab and bung the electrodes on your head and see on the EEG machine what kind of brain waves are coming out. It's not just a kind of a technical exercise in shifting the way that your brain works. That's not kind of religion. That's only capturing a very, very kind of trivial and shallow slice of what the whole thing is. Often we feel, and this is something which we doubt intellectually, but also emotionally, we feel somehow these different aspects tugging against each other, bumping up against each other. Meditation and the community life, the stillness of contemplation, and then the activity of working. And so on and so forth. And I think it's a shame that these things are often presented or taught as being somehow in opposition with each other. And I think as soon as we start perceiving of different aspects of our religion as being in opposition to each other, then we're kind of in trouble. And so rather than looking for how these things are in opposition to each other, we should be looking for how they are helping each other, how they're supporting each other. And if you're finding that these are problems for you, then you should recognize it, and then you should try to overcome it. I remember when I was first an Anagarika, when I was at Nanachan, and they made me an Anagarika, or Pakao as they call them there, just before the Sangha went on retreat to Dadam. So this is very kind of deep jungle in Dadam, and we all went out there, and they usually need a pakao or two to carry the money and do the cooking. So I was the one of the Anagarikas there. The other one, how can I say this in a nice way, got scared and ran away because of the snakes. I remember one time, you know, because we were out there the monks didn't have much to do in the way of chores and things like that. We were just staying on bamboo platforms in the jungle, so there wasn't much chores and stuff. But I was doing quite a lot of work because I was working in the kitchen, so I was spending, you know, 4 or 5 hours every morning cooking. And I remember one time, Ajahn, we were at the top sala where we'd have drinks and things like that, and there was a metal, what they call a gulamung, like it's a big metal basin that was used for boiling water, and I think the water was going to be boiled for washing the robes or something like that. And the gulamung that they had was very dirty, crusted with ash. And so Ajahn Pasano asked me if I would clean it. And so you cleaned it by taking it to the creek and scrubbing the ash off with sand. And And I remember this kind of thought arising in me, oh, I didn't come here to bloody do all this bloody work. I probably didn't use the word bloody, I probably used another word, which I won't repeat here. And, you know, how come all of these monks are sitting there and they're not doing any work and I'm working all of this time, bloody, 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 and then I'm going to have to go and do it. Of course, actually, it's quite a fun job to do and it only takes, it doesn't take all that long to do it. It's not such a big deal. Although I must admit, one of the bloodies was reserved for the fact that I was wearing white clothes, so washing this kind of ash-scarred metal thing in a stream in white clothes was an extra degree of angst. Anyway, I kind of washed, but you know, I could recognise when that thought came up. I recognised, hang on, that's not wholesome, and there's something really in there, and I need to overcome that. And because I recognised it very quickly. I managed to overcome it, and it was never a kind of a big deal for me after that, really. And you know, I was thinking about and reflecting on it, and realizing that actually, you know, these things are all interconnected. When I'm doing these works, I shouldn't be thinking how they're obstructing each other. If I'm working and I'm thinking, oh, this is taking me away from a meditation time, and there I was all peaceful and so on last night, and if only I could continue to meditate, then I'd be able to keep that peacefulness, but now all of these people around me are talking, yamma, 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 why are they going on so much, and it's so distracting, and so on. And when you allow these kinds of ways of thinking to proliferate, then the different parts of your mind are separating out from each other, they're dividing out from each other, and battling each other, conflicting, and it's creating a kind of an unwholesome state in your mind. And you can very easily get in a situation where if these boundaries and these breakages in the mind become strong, where you can then go back into meditation and, you know, you reject all of those other things, you block them out, and you go back into meditation, and then you can have a nice peaceful time in meditation. But then you come out of it again, and then somehow it's gone. So the fact that you're meditating and your meditation is going well is not by itself going to guarantee that that these other aspects are going to go smoothly. It's something else. It's something that we have to also develop, is the integration of these different things. So there's no great secret to it. It's nothing particularly complicated to do. It just means that when we are doing these different aspects, that we take the time, and it don't have to take much, but just take the time to remind ourselves that these different parts and different aspects of our life actually are all useful and all good in their own way, that they all nourish us in some way, and that they all enable us to nourish others in some way as well. So when we come to meditate, we can reflect before we start to meditate, okay, I'm meditating in order to purify my mind, to find peace, to find enlightenment. And also recognize that process is going to be something which is of benefit to others, that through becoming a kinder, more wise person, I can live my life in a way that's more helpful and beneficial for others. Remind yourself that is actually happening. Don't doubt that. Don't think that it's not happening, right? Don't think that somehow the meditation that you're doing in your heart is not doing any good for anybody else. It is. And you should remind yourself of that. And remind yourself that it's possible for me to do this because of all of the other things which people have done, because of the dana which has been offered, because of the work that somebody did in building this hut, because of the effort that's gone into sustaining the community that supports the monastery, because of the teachings, because of the support of my friends in the community, and all of these things. And so we remind ourselves, actually, that this meditation is not just something that just happens. The fact that I can have this time and this space here in this beautiful, quiet, natural environment, it's not just an accident. It's come because of a clear intention and because of a dedication and effort and energy from many, many people to allow it to take place. And so we remind ourselves with that and use that to energize your practice. You know, use it to remind yourself of your gratitude, remind yourself of the benefits of what you're doing, remind yourself that so many people are supporting you and encouraging you, that people who understand when things are difficult, and they will rejoice with you when things go well. And similarly, when you're joining with others and joining in the community, to remind yourself that this is not the time for solo mindfulness practice. This is not the time for pretending I'm in my kuti doing nothing. I'm not in my kuti doing nothing. If I'm here with this person, my job is to listen to this person. My job is to communicate with them. If I'm doing some work, my job is to do the work as best as I can, to try to be as helpful as I possibly can, to serve as much as I possibly can, to give back as much as I possibly can. And this is not separate from meditation or my study or my understanding of Buddhism in other aspects. It's a part of it. It's a part of that service. So this is by reflecting in this way, we give everything in our life a sense of meaning. So whenever we sweep a path, it's not just moving leaves around. Yeah? And so this is the difference between like a reductionist or a materialist approach, where things just become a kind of a you know, it's just a matter of kind of the lowest common denominator. Whatever that you're doing, it is given meaning. And there's a very lovely anecdote about that. And it's a story that was told about building one of the great cathedrals in Europe. And a pilgrim came to the site where they were building this cathedral, and he wandered around the site, and he spoke to one man, and he said, "You know, what are you doing? What's your job here?" And he said, "Well, I'm the architect. My job is to, I've designed the spires and the flying buttresses, and my job is to make sure all of the everything looks beautiful and proportional." And he said, "Oh, that's fantastic, wonderful." And he went to see somebody else. He said, "What's your job here?" He said, "Well, I'm the engineer. My job is to make sure that everything is solid and sturdy and lasts for a long time." And he said, "Oh, that's wonderful." And he went to see somebody else who was cutting the stone. He said, "What's your job?" And he said, "Well, I'm the stonemason. My job is to shape each piece of stone to make sure that it will fit properly." And he said, "Oh, that's wonderful." And then there was a little old woman who was had a broom and was cleaning up things around the building site. And he went and asked her, "What's your role here?" And she said, I'm helping to build a house of God." So of course it's that little old woman who was the only one who was actually doing it properly. Everybody else is so caught up in what they were doing, in their skills, their contribution, and they've become just a matter of ego. What can I do? How can I be remembered? Whereas for her, it was a matter of service. It was a matter of, it doesn't matter how humble it is that what I'm doing. It doesn't matter that I'm just moving bits of dirt around the place. I'm helping to build a house of God. And so this is also how we should think of everything that we do here. If we're fixing the Land Cruiser, I'm not just bashing a piece of metal with a hammer. Yeah, I am helping to, I don't know, what do you say, building a house of God? You don't say that in Buddhism. How would you say it? I'm building a vehicle to transport beings to the far shore. Yeah. Or whatever, I think you understand what I'm getting at. So if we keep on practicing by bringing these things in, then we include everything within the sacred. You know, they have this idea in anthropology of the sacred and the profane, and the sacred essentially is something which is separated from ordinary life. So it's closed off either by time or by space. And you know, you go around and do everything in your life, and then there's a special thing which is there, which you maybe encounter once a week or something like that, and that's the sacred, the holy thing. And the holy doesn't have to be anything. In fact, in many religions, it's actually just nothing, but it's very separateness which is what makes it holy. So in monastic life, we have a somewhat different relationship with the sacred. In a sense, our whole lives are sacred by being wrapped in the robes. We are the sacred and separate object for the lay community. Of course, that's not how we perceive it. We just perceive it as being ordinary everyday clothes that we just put on and go to work, you know, and do our stuff. But from outside, it's perceived as being something which is special and sacred. So we should try to bring that attitude in so that our Buddhist practice is not just doing the chanting, it's not just bowing to the Buddha, it's not just reading the suttas, it's not just doing the meditation. These things is where the Dhamma practice becomes most concentrated, I guess, most most precise or most specific, but it's something which should flow out and imbue everything that we do, every word that we say, everything, every act that we perform becomes Dhamma. It becomes an expression of what the Buddha was teaching. And so I think that this, in this sense, this is something that gets to what I think of what a religion is the sense that you have this highest value, this, in Latin they call it the summum bonum, it's the ultimate good. In Pali we use the word paramatta, it's the same meaning, the highest good. And so you have this highest good, which for Buddhists is nibbana, the ending of greed, hatred and delusion, the ending of suffering, the ending of samsara, the realization of what the Buddha said, nibbanam paramam sukham, nibbana is ultimate bliss. And so this is that's like the high point, that's the question of ultimate concern. And that informs and gives a context and gives meaning to everything else that we do. So everything that we do, if we think, and this is not just in an abstract sense, it's not just an idea. The most practical way of thinking about Nibbana is that Nibbana is the ending of greed, hatred and delusion. So if we think of it in that way, then every time, every moment, well, do we have greed, hatred and delusion or do we not? And so everything that we do, we can try to overcome greed, hatred and delusion. And every time we let go of that, even a little bit, we're moving towards Nibbana, just a little bit. So this is, when I'm saying that this highest truth of Nibbana is something which should inform and imbue everything in our life, I'm not meaning that in just an abstract sense. It's actually a very real, practical reality. It gives an orientation, it gives a context, it gives us a way of checking what it is that we're doing. Is what I'm doing conducive? Does it help to actually let go of greed, hatred and delusion? How can I use this context here in this place doing this thing with this person? How can I use this to overcome greed, hatred and delusion? So these are the ways that we use to deepen and to broaden our religious practice, to take it beyond purely the specific devotional and contemplative practices of Buddhism and use it to be something to inform everything that we do. So this is my little talk for you this evening on the notion of religion as I understand it and how that applies to the practice of Buddhism. So I offer this for your reflection.